Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is David Clary, author of a new book entitled Gangsters to Governors, The New Bosses of Gambling America. David Clary is a news editor of the San Diego Union-Tribune. This is his first book. David Clary, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
This book took you 6 years to write. What were your goals in starting the book, and do you believe you met those goals?
Yeah, so my goals were, I've always been fascinated by gambling. I myself, I'm kind of a light gambler and not particularly good at it, so I'm not someone you should probably come to for gambling tips. But I've always been fascinated by gambling, horse racing, casinos. And I think what I wanted to do is I wanted to connect all the forms of gambling and try to tell the overall story of gambling's legalization in America. So the story, you know, really starts in modern America with pari-mutuel betting at horse racetracks in the 1930s, mostly. And it was really the first time that states derived direct revenue from gambling. It was about the 30s. They had racetracks like Del Mar here in San Diego and others opening up. And, you know, governors and governments really wanted, they were strapped for money, and they saw gambling, horse race bets as a way of generating revenue. And then from there, some states started getting into the lottery business in the 60s and the 70s especially. And then you started seeing riverboat casinos in the 80s, you know, in the Mississippi River, dockside casinos down in Mississippi and New Orleans. And then from there, it's expanded into some states are doing online betting. And so I think I just was interested in telling the story and connecting all those dots. And I think I succeeded. It took a lot of research. Like you say, it took 6 years because it's a lot of different forms of gambling to understand and understand their development and then understand how they all connect. Because, you know, it really was a domino effect. Once you legalize one form of gambling, it's very hard to say this other form of gambling isn't right. So it really was a domino effect over the last 70 or 80 years.
One of the things that you talked about in the book is that the government has used gambling as a way to raise revenue from the very beginning, even before there was a government.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about how the government, or not even the government back then, but how they used lotteries to finance things in the beginning?
Yeah, that's right. Even in the colonial period, the state governments would run lotteries to raise money for if they needed a bridge in their town or they needed to build a church or help build a university. Lotteries were a way of raising revenue in colonial America and in early America. There weren't many banks around back then, so there wasn't really a form of taxation, you know, especially in the colonial era. There wasn't a way of raising taxes, you know, through the way we understand it now. So lotteries were really a well-used instrument of public finance. So that goes all the way back to the founding of the country, and then the lotteries fell into corruption and they were really wiped away for about 70 years until the 1960s is when we saw the first state-sanctioned lotteries. And during that time, it was controlled by organized crime, and you hear about the numbers rackets. They were extremely popular, especially in urban areas, and they helped finance organized crime activities, illegal activities, for many years until the states got control of them.
As a real good example of corruption, the Louisiana State Lottery Company is a good example of a bad example.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah, that's right. You know, like I said, the state lotteries fell into corruption in the 1800s, and then around the time after the Civil War, the only one left standing was Louisiana Lottery Company, and it basically had a monopoly on lotteries in America. And it was sort of a quirk of the Louisiana law that it was allowed to exist. There was rampant corruption and bribery to keep its foothold in Louisiana. It had offices all across the country. It was extremely lucrative, and they had so much money they could buy off politicians. I mean, they really owned the state for much of the last part of the 1800s. And it became so powerful that it took an act of Congress, it took the U.S. Supreme Court decision, it took the President of the United States to finally shut it down. And it was around the turn of the century when it finally faded away, but it really took all three branches of the federal government to crack down on it, because it really became such a pestilence on the people, and it was just so corrupt. And then they really dealt a body blow to lotteries that lasted about 60 or 70 years.
Generally speaking, the story about organized crime in the history of Las Vegas is well known. Did you learn anything new as you looked into this era of American gambling?
Yeah, one thing I didn't know, I knew like the rough outlines of that story. Some of it, there is a mob mythology you have to pierce when you take on a project like this. You know, you hear about Bugsy Siegel invented Las Vegas. And I think there's that movie Bugsy that Warren Beatty was in. And, you know, that's really a kind of a Hollywood myth of what really happened. I mean, there were two other casinos, in existence before the Flamingo. And then, you know, when Siegel opened the Flamingo, it actually was a failure when an opening night was a disaster. And then he was killed pretty soon after that. And then it became a success after he died. So it's not, I mean, I think it's more of a myth than a reality. So just separating the myth and reality took some time. But one thing I didn't know about that era was the role of Howard Hughes. You know, I think we know Howard Hughes as a Hollywood producer. We know him as an aviator, a very rich man. But I didn't know that he was really instrumental in Las Vegas in the 1960s. Yeah, he moved there in 1966, and he moved into the top of the Desert Inn, which was then owned by organized crime interests. And some time passed, a few months passed, and the owners said, or the hotel said, you know, you guys need to leave because you're not gambling, you're just staying on this floor, and we've got New Year's Eve coming, we've got some big high rollers that need these rooms. And he said, how about I just buy the hotel? So he bought the Desert Inn, and Howard Hughes was one of the richest men in the world at that time, and he could do that. And then he bought five other casinos that were in organized crime hands in Las Vegas over the next 4 years. So the people, the governor and the city leaders loved it because they knew that he was not tied to organized crime. He wasn't tied to the Teamsters. His money was clean. And so they really embraced him as a way of dislodging a lot of these organized crime interests from these hotels. And then he left Las Vegas 4 years later. He never once set foot in any of his other hotels. He only stayed on the penthouse of the Desert Inn those entire 4 years. So he was a really fascinating story to me. I didn't know about that, and I spent a lot of time looking into him.
Yeah, when I moved here in the late 70s, not only did he own a lot of the casinos, but he was one, if not the biggest, he was one of the biggest landowners
in
Las Vegas.
That's right.
And, you know, after he died, all that land was tied up. But if you drove down Flamingo Road east toward what now there's the Hughes Center and all of that, that was all vacant land.
Yeah.
And because he owned all of it, and it all was tied up in lawsuits after his death. So.
Well, yeah. The northwest part of town called Summerland was all part of his holdings.
That's probably his greatest legacy to Las Vegas is that community. You know, because none of his hotels survived. He was not a casino operator. He didn't invent. You know, wasn't like Kirk Kerkorian or Steve Wynn or some of these other figures that really were trailblazers in gambling. He just really bought these old hotels and didn't really do much to them. So. But he still is important in sort of that transition from Las Vegas under organized crime to Las Vegas as we know it today, as in an era of corporate control and coordination with government.
Yeah, at that time he also owned the land on both sides of the strip, from the Desert Inn and the Silver Slipper at the north end, on both sides all the way down to Caesar's Palace and the Sands.
That's right.
So let's change subjects a little bit. Most of your book talks about various types of gambling, and they do really well for a while, and then they don't do so well. Las Vegas has been able to reinvent itself a number of times and still remains at the top of American gambling destinations in the face of significant competition of various stripes. Do you predict this to continue?
I think it will. I think Las Vegas is just a singular place, and I think they've done a very good job in recent years of being more than just a gambling destination. I think for a lot of people go there because they like the restaurants. They've got, you know, every famous chef has a restaurant in Las Vegas, and they've got nightclubs that are extremely popular with young people. They've got lots of, you know, there's concerts all the time, mainstream concerts, and, you know, comedians. You look at any of those big resort hotels, they've got top of the line spas and pool areas. So I think they've done really a very good job at being more than just a gambling destination. I think they've realized that that's just not enough. You can't, there's 1,000 casinos across this country now, and this isn't the 1970s where the only place you could gamble was illegally was Nevada. So I think that the people in Las Vegas realize that they've got to offer a lot more than just a bunch of slot machines and blackjack tables. It's just not going to be enough to have it survive. So I think that they're well positioned to stay in a strong position. In terms of gambling, and they also have a wonderful, a very strong convention business, which it assures you have a steady flow of people every week. So they've got enormous convention centers. So I think they've done a very good job of being something more than just a gambling place.
Let's contrast that with Atlantic City. Atlantic City was the second gambling destination in the country, and they had their own history of organized crime.
Right.
But now they seem to be sinking. Do you see it remaining a significant gambling destination in this country?
Well, I think not in the same sense as Las Vegas. I think if you look back at Atlantic City, when they legalized casino in 1978, I think the first one opened, it was the only place outside of Nevada where you could legally bet in a casino. So it was a sensation. And in the 1980s, I think Atlantic City was the most visited place in America, you know, even more than Disneyland. It was, cause you think of all the people from New York City who would go on the buses and go down to Atlantic City for the day, and all the people in Philadelphia and surrounding states. So when they had a monopoly, they did great. But then, as what happens when you have competition, it starts to undercut. And they, Pennsylvania now has a very strong casino industry, and Philadelphia has casinos right downtown. Maryland is strong, with casinos, lots of casinos there now. Delaware, then you have the Foxwoods and, Connecticut, you know, so a lot of those New York City traffic went up there and went up north instead of south. So I think it's, I think there'll always be gambling in Atlantic City. I just think it's going to be smaller, and it has contracted. I mean, they've lost a third of their casinos in the last 5 years. And I think if they can understand that it's just going to be a smaller market, I think they'll be fine. But it's just difficult because I think governors are so used to a certain amount of revenue from these casinos and from gambling. And they want to preserve that at all costs. And I think we saw that with Atlantic City, where Chris Christie he really tried so hard to expand revenue and sort of make Atlantic City great again. And it just wasn't going to happen. The market just isn't there anymore. So I think a much more reduced market could succeed there, but and I think they're seeing that that's happening kind of automatically, that people are voting with their feet.
you, this wasn't covered in the book, but you've, within the last year, they've opened another casino in San Diego. How has that expansion of gambling in San Diego affected it?
You know, I think, sort of like a, like I said with Las Vegas, I think the Indian casinos here have done a good job of kind of realizing that they have to offer more than just slot machines and some table games. I think we have about 10 in the county now, and they're all in, you know, remote parts of the San Diego. There's none in the San Diego city limits. So you have to, drive out a bit to get to them. But I think they've done a generally a good job. I mean, they expand when the demand is there. They don't just build, you know, 1,000 hotel rooms and then complain that, you know, only 200 people are staying here every night. So their growth, I think, has been pretty intelligent, and they also offer the golf courses and convention space and concerts. So there's other things to bring people out there other than gambling. So they've been real savvy, I think, about, you know, staying relevant and, building a good business model.
Sports betting. And gambling. Right now, basically, Las Vegas is the only place you can legally gamble on sports. And lots of people use bookies elsewhere. Major League Sports had wanted nothing to do with Las Vegas, but now we have a professional hockey team, which is doing pretty good, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And the Oakland Raiders are going to be moving here in a few years. Now, how did this all come about?
Yeah, that's been that was a really interesting part of this research, is that the kind of shifting attitudes towards sports betting. The leagues historically have been opposed to legalized sports betting. That goes back to, I think there have been so many scandals in the history of sports, you know, going back to 1919, you know, the Black Sox scandal, and, you know, you can trace it all the way through Pete Rose, and there have been scandals in the NFL with betting, and college basketball, certainly. So I think there's been a concern that it would taint the product, and they've always historically been against it. And then a few years ago, the NBA commissioner Adam Silver, I think he wrote out that piece in the New York Times that basically said, you know, let's grow up and realize that, you know, we need to legalize sports betting, and let's make it regulated. Let's be open about it. I mean, it drives a lot of the ratings for sports. I mean, people watch football games. I mean, a lot of them are watching their fantasy teams, or they're watching their bets. They're not really watching the play on the field. They're continuing to watch the game because they're watching the money. So I think the leagues have kind of belatedly understood that. And also some of the leagues have formed partnerships with daily fantasy sports. So that kind of undercuts the argument against sports betting. I mean, it's that kind of daily fantasy kind of exists in a legal gray zone in a lot of states. So, but the fact that some of the teams and leagues are partnering with them, you see, you know, signs for FanDuel and DraftKings and stadiums and arenas it's like, okay, how can you really be that against sports betting if you're okay with that? And that's hard to say that that's not a form of gambling, although that's in dispute. So I think it's just been reality. I think the leagues just realize, you know, where so much of the fan interest is derived. And then there's, as you probably know, there's a big case before the Supreme Court this term. I think the oral arguments are going to be in December. So what that is it's New Jersey is challenging the federal ban on sports betting. Like you say, only Nevada offers a legal single game sports betting. And the New Jersey is claiming that federal ban on sports betting is unconstitutional. So if the court rules in New Jersey's favor, that could very well open up illegal sports betting to states across the country. You know, if states want to do it, they could offer it in their offer of sports books like you see in Las Vegas. So I think that's going to be a really fascinating thing to watch in the next 6 to 8 months. You know, I think the court's term ends in June, so it won't be any later than that before we know, you know, how they rule on that case.
Well, this has been an ongoing saga, and in the preliminary rounds, New Jersey has consistently lost. They've been trying this for a number of years. Is there any reason to believe they'll succeed this time?
Yeah, it's always hard to predict what the court's going to do. I mean, you're right. And I think this case actually started in 2009, and when Chris Christie took office, and now he's about to leave office after two terms, and the case is still pending. So it's rattled around the lower courts for years, and like you say, New Jersey has been on the losing side a lot of those cases. But the Supreme Court doesn't usually take cases unless they want to set some. Yeah, you know, they see a constitutional issue at play here. So, yeah, I don't know. I think the changing attitudes of the leagues. I mean, I think if you asked the leagues back in 2009 with how they felt about legalizing sports betting, I think they would be against it, even though they are on the opposite side of this case. I mean, I think certainly Adam Silver is, from the NBA has, softened his position on it. And, I think that there's just, I think society has changed. I think there's, the sense that, we will watch ESPN now, and there's open talk of sports, of point spread, which was unheard of. I mean, you never heard that, sometimes Al Michaels would kind of make a allusion to it, or Brett Musburger would talk about the boys in the desert, and now it's pretty openly said, what the point spreads are. And it's, so I think the culture has changed. And I think there's a feeling that, it's happening. 99% of sports betting is done illegally, and it's an unregulated market, which is always dangerous. And, I think there's a sense that, let's bring it out to light, and let's be grown-ups about it, and let's realize this is happening. And maybe by tracking the movement of money, you can also track, irregularities, and you can track, corruption. So I think the ground is primed for it now.
For me, it has a feeling of inevitability about it, the same way that gay marriage and legalized marijuana did. You just can feel that the country has moved in this direction and everyone is ready for it. And in addition, the government, the various state governments need revenue. And they look at it much like any gambling, much like marijuana. Here's a chance to gain a lot of revenue without adding taxes to the individuals. So I can't imagine that it won't be here soon.
Yeah, I agree. And you have, I think you mentioned, the Las Vegas has an NHL team. 31 owners voted for the Raiders to move there. So I think that would have been unheard of 10 years ago, even. I think there's still ridiculous, rules on the books. I think the NCAA tournament doesn't allow any games to be played in Nevada because of, sports betting, which is absurd, but the NCAA has plenty of absurd rules, as we know. But I think you're right. I think I saw a poll early this year that said a majority of Americans, favor legalized sports betting, which is the first time that's been in the plus territory. So I think you're right. I think the attitudes are changing, and, gambling is so pervasive in our culture as well that, I think that, like I said earlier, I mean, you legalize one form of betting, it's hard to say that, sports betting isn't right, but you can buy lottery tickets 24 hours a day and at 7-Elevens. It just, I think it becomes hard to say that sports betting isn't, should be continue to be banned.
Richard compared this to gay marriage and marijuana. Although those things have passed in many places, there is still significant opposition to it among certain people. So the same is probably true of sports betting. You have your strong opposition to it, mm-hmm. in addition to there are people in favor of it. So it always comes down to politics, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's true. And,
which means money.
Right. And I think this is one of our last bipartisan issues because you really see governors on both sides. Chris Christie's a Republican. He's been a very forceful advocate for it. And, Andrew Cuomo, in New York is a Democrat, and he's pushed for, expanding commercial casino gambling. So, Oklahoma is a very conservative state, but there's casinos all over the place there. So it's, I think it's just, I think when governors see a chance to make money, they'll grab onto it.
You mentioned fantasy sports. A couple years ago, you would see all kinds of advertisements on television for fantasy sports, and that's changed a lot. Nevada has kind of ruled against it, and several other states have put restrictions in there. Where do you see that's going?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a hard road for fantasy sports. I think it's really going to be a state by state war of attrition for fantasy to really catch on. I mean, like you say, there's states that have enacted bans on it, and there's some states where you can do it. I don't know. I just wonder if the Supreme Court case, if they rule in favor of New Jersey, I just wonder if that's going to take out a lot of the wind of the sails of daily fantasy. Because I think it's more, for me personally, I think it's more appealing to bet on teams than on constructing my own fantasy team and drafting it and following it. I just don't want to bother with it. I just want to, just want to bet on the game. I don't want to go through the hassle of trading players, and it just takes up too much time. So I just wonder if that's if sports betting, team sports betting is legalized, if that's going to even take the wind out of the sails of fantasy sports even more.
Very good. We are talking to David Clary, author of the book Gangsters to Governors. We're going to take a brief commercial break here, and we have lots more questions for Mr. Clary coming up soon. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In November, the month-long promotion involves half-price Smith's $50 gift cards. Normally $50 in cash or free plays earned by earning and redeeming 16,667 points. Now in November, if you earn and redeem half that number, 8,334, you get the gift card. There's a limit of 10 gift cards per person. On Thanksgiving Day, 320 players will each earn $100 in a hot seat promotion, where the money is given out approximately once every 3 minutes between 8 a.m. and midnight. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The monthly game is a new game called Haywire. It is an 8-coin per line game where periodically you get multipliers on the bottom line, and that multiplier is good on that one line only. On the next hand, you get the multiplier on the second line. It may be the same multiplier, or it may be a different multiplier. On the next hand, you get the multiplier on the third line, and it goes up. The multipliers range between 2x and 12x, and it's possible to have more than one multiplier at a time. EV-wise, it is never a good idea to leave unplayed multipliers, although you can bet that if you do, there will be a player coming around shortly to play it off for you. Strategically, you need to make no strategy adjustments. Whatever the multiplier is, the strategy stays the same. This is in some way similar to Super Times Pay, where you get multipliers, but in Super Times Pay, you get the multipliers on all the lines at once. Here it is one line at a time, which means you can get more frequent multipliers and also bigger multipliers when they're only one line at a time. All right, we're talking to David Clary, author of the book Gangsters to Governors. Online gaming. It's a relatively low ebb right now compared to the way it was prior to 2006. It has a well-financed adversary in Sheldon Adelson. What do you see the future is for online gaming in the United States?
I think I kind of see it as maybe a state of slow expansion. Right now, it's New Jersey, again, has a full suite of online gaming options, so poker, the typical casino games. I think that's the only state where they really have the full run of gambling options online. And then Nevada, I believe, is just the poker, online poker is legalized. And I think Delaware also has that. So it's very, very small right now. I don't know. I can see states slowly dipping into it, but I think the problem with it is that the returns have just been very meager in terms of what was expected. I know in Nevada, the online poker returns were so bad they stopped reporting them. They're just so minimal that it's not, they really don't even think it's worth sending out a statement every month at what the revenue is. And New Jersey has done a bit better, but still, it's only a fraction of what they derive from, actual casinos, brick and mortar casinos. So I mean, I can see states experimenting with it, online poker is a way to start. But I just think, I think it's going to be pretty slow, and it's pretty uncertain too.
To me, it is another one of those that I think is inevitable, but I think it'll take longer. Again, they need the revenue, and they see it as a source of revenue. But I thought New Jersey was actually doing quite well not with the online poker, but once they added actual online gambling. And now the poker also should go up because they've voted to pool the players from the three states. So
that's right.
More liquidity in the market should help that a lot.
But yeah, it could be a similar journey as was taken with lotteries, because lotteries started very slow as well, and they were kind of in isolated markets. And I think only when you start pooling the play and you start having bigger jackpots, was there more interest? I think it could follow a similar path as lotteries. Once we got the Powerball and the Mega Millions, that's when you really saw the hundreds of millions of dollars of jackpots rising. But when the lottery started, the jackpots were like $100,000, which by the time you take the taxes out of it, it's not exactly life-changing. I mean, it's great, but it's not like you're not going to change your life over, $40,000. I think it, like you say, it's, poker requires liquidity. And I think if more states enter the market and start banding together, then I can see maybe a critical mass building. But I think it's going to take a while. And, it's already been, 5 or 6 years, I think, since it was legalized. And we're still only with three states. And I think the states are being careful about it. And, you have to have the regulation. You have to have the, the ability to make sure that you don't have players from other states, coming in. And so it takes a lot of, regulation. I think some states are unwilling to do right now.
Well, also, as Bob mentioned, Sheldon Adelson is putting a lot of money into preventing it, but he's in his 80s and he won't be around that much longer. And, I think that'll grease the wheels somewhat once he's out of the picture.
That's a good point too. I mean, but when someone has $30 billion, it's a pretty large voice at the table. But yeah, like you say, I mean, if he passes on and whoever takes over the company, it probably won't have the same kind of resistance to online gambling that he has.
Skipping way back to the start of your book.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about a man named John Old Smoke Morrissey. Now, I had not heard of him by name. Who was he, and what did he do?
Yeah, he was one of the real pleasures of doing this book and delving into the research is learning so much. I never heard of him either. And he was an Irish immigrant in the 1800s. He was a brawler. He was a bare-knuckled boxing champion. And he was also a fixture in the Tammany Hall machine. You hear about the machine politics era. Well, he was part of that as an enforcer. So he would politicians would send him out to enforce certain things they wanted to have done. And he became a gambling impresario. He had a really nice gambling business in New York City. And at that time, a lot of the rich folks in New York City, they went up to Saratoga Springs, to take in the waters. They have a spa there. That's a beautiful spot. And he started a casino there, and actually the building is still there. You can go visit it. It's right in the center of town. And so he became friendly with people like the Vanderbilts and the Whitneys. They would come up in the summers and gamble and just enjoy the being outside of the city for the summer. And a lot of the rich folks there said, you know, it'd be great to have a racetrack here. And so Morrissey was instrumental in opening Saratoga Racecourse, which in 1863, and it's the oldest racecourse still running in America, and it's, you know, one of our top sporting venues still in use. And so he was one of the leaders of that track, and you know, it's still today a prestigious, probably one of the most prestigious racetracks in the country. And then he ended up being a congressman, and so yeah, he just was a really fascinating character, and just not somebody you would expect to be rubbing shoulders with the Vanderbilts and the Whitneys. He was pretty rough, but he was an important figure in the development of Saratoga, certainly.
And wasn't Canfield another one of the early?
That's right.
Casino owners.
Yeah, when Morrissey died, Canfield basically took over that casino, and he was an important figure in casino gambling as well. I think that casino is actually called the Canfield Casino if you go visit it. It's still on the side of the building. So he was also really a very important figure in casino betting, and especially for the high rollers. Only the high rollers went to these places. And what was interesting is that the casinos were really for the high rollers, and the racetrack, you know, anybody could go to. So it was sort of gambling for everybody. You know, there was a way to bet for everybody.
Horse racing appears to be on a downhill slide and is much smaller now than it was decades ago. Do you see it rebounding?
No, I really don't. I think it's just in a state of kind of perpetual decline. I think horse racing is great, but I just think the breeding isn't what it used to be. A lot of tracks, major tracks have closed. Hollywood Park out here in California closed, and they're actually going to build a new football NFL stadium on that site. I think that the city, you know, you'll always have the Triple Crown. You'll have Del Mar. You'll have the real big tracks. I think they'll be okay, but I think the smaller tracks are really struggling. And what a lot of states have done is they've legalized what they call racinos, where they build they basically put a slot parlor next to a racetrack, and it sort of props up the racetrack because it brings people come in for the slots, or some have table games even, and they. And so it really keeps, it's really kept all these tracks open. So, but horse racing itself, I think, is not strong enough to sustain a lot of these tracks. So tracks that don't have a slot parlor attached to them, I think are going to be in trouble. And I just think the fan interest in the sport has declined, you know, over years. I mean, people are always interested when the Kentucky Derby is on, and this weekend is the Breeders' Cup, and is, certainly a lot of interest around here about that, but I just think it's a sport that's in decline, and I just think it's hard to see it rebounding.
You know, I think a big problem with that was the lack of marketing to young people. You know, if you go to Japan and Hong Kong, where horse racing is huge, if you go to the track or to the OTB parlors, they're full of young people, and you know, it's an event for people to go to. But the horse racing industry in America just never did any marketing to young people to get them interested in it. And so, yeah, it's just gone steadily downhill.
Yeah, that's actually my first introduction to gambling was horse racing, because I grew up in upstate New York. And my parents would take me to Saratoga a lot, and the Traverse Stakes. And we'd go to Vernon Downs, was a much smaller track that we'd go to. And that was my first exposure to it. And I was, as a kid, I was kind of struck by it. Like, it's all old guys here, you know, it's all, and then sometimes you pass by OTB parlors, because that was legal in New York State. And And they, you know, it was all like kind of old men in there. And, I think you're right. I think it does have a marketing problem. In Del Mar, you know, here in San Diego, they do a good job of making it into something like the ads are kind of sexy and they have these, women in these incredible hats and they have concerts and cocktails. And I think that at least here, they've done a very good job of marketing it for something that 20s and 30s people would be interested in going to, making it something kind of fun. And, of course, it's right by the ocean. So, you're going to have fun, but I think there is a marketing issue with that. I think it does seem like it, even when you go to those sports books and you see the guys playing the horses, it's like, they're all kind of old guys and they don't seem that excited and just sort of sitting there all day and looking down at the racing form. It's not too appealing, but I've taken my kids to the Del Mar and they love it. I'll say, just pick a few horses and, you pick this race and I'll just, give you, I'll play $10, and of course they always win and I always lose. So, kids always seem to have a sense of, what the right horses to pick. So I guess I'm passing it on to the next generation.
For our listeners who are wondering about things, we're taping the show approximately 2 weeks before it actually airs. So when, David said the Breeders' Cup is this weekend, it was a while ago by the time you're hearing this, so don't let that bother you. That's just, we had to do it because there's a vacation schedules for Richard and I, which we're kind of work around. So one of the things I thought was interesting was on the beginnings of the NFL. And most of the beginning of the NFLs, the owners had gambling connections. I did not know this, and talk a bit about that. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that was another thing I didn't know. Art Rooney in Pittsburgh was a bookie, an avid track player. I think one of the first commissioners, Bert Bell, was also a very heavy gambler, very involved. He knew all the characters. I think the Maras were bookmakers as well. You look at the DNA of almost every old NFL team. I mean, George Halas was involved as well with the Bears. Was involved in either bookmaking or horse racing in some way. So yeah, the NFL really does have gambling embedded in their DNA. I think a lot of people don't realize that, which makes the league's current stand against gambling hypocritical to me. It's really part of their history and it's a reality.
But their history. I can't imagine that any of the NFL owners don't bet on football. I'd be amazed if that were true.
Yeah, and I think we always see stories about. Athletes betting. Phil Mickelson is a big bettor. Charles Barkley, Michael Jordan. I think gambling is just something that goes hand in hand with sports. Because I think you want to prove your knowledge and you want to show that you want the bragging rights. And I think when I hear stories about athletes playing golf, just for fun, and like they'll bet $100,000 on a hole or on a round, and it's just, I think it makes it exciting for them. And sports is all about the adrenaline rush, and and so gambling is also about the adrenaline rush as well. So yeah, the two really go hand in hand.
You mentioned hypocritical, and I think that's the wrong word here. Gambling and mobsters is definitely in Las Vegas's DNA. Mm-hmm. And so now the Nevada very much wants no mobsters here at all. It wants to redefine itself and get rid of the corruption, and it pretty much has.
Yet at the same time, play it up as part of its history, right, with the mob museum and such.
So I don't find it hypocritical that they want to redefine themselves.
Mm-hmm.
No, yeah. I agree with David, Bob, because the NFL to try to claim we don't want the taint of gambling when all the owners are betting on the games and they have this history of gambling attached to them. That's the hypocritical part.
Yeah, and plus the owners know that the gambling is what drives the ratings. I mean, there's no question about it. It's why would you keep watching a game that's, you know, a 30 to 14 game in the fourth quarter if you don't have money on it? I mean, why on earth would you watch two bad teams play? You know, the ratings are driven by gambling. I mean, it's so clear, and I think the owners are. You know, I think they're beginning to understand that, but it's been belated.
I think they just want their peace.
Oh, sure.
They're trying to figure out how to get their cut.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. 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 I think Bob has a point too, though, where I think Las Vegas does market, the kind of the mob angle they've shuffled off a lot of the mobsters. I don't think there's any organized crime in charge of any casino there now, or hasn't been for quite a while. But they do have that sense of vice and it's Sin City and so there's untoward things happening around the corner. So I think they do use that kind of that history as a maybe a little bit of a marketing. Edge to make people feel like, oh yeah, you might see a gangster around the corner when in fact you're not going to see that these days in Las Vegas.
Well, what you will see is Pete Rose.
Yes, right.
Pete Rose has made he definitely bet on baseball, and he's made a career. I mean, he's on the blacklist or whatever they call it, but he's made a career out of signing baseball, shaking hands, and talking about how unfair it is that he can't get into the Hall of Fame. And he'll have that same conversation 4 days a week, and he's been having it for several years, and that's the way he makes a very nice living now.
Right. He signs autographs like 4 days a week at the Mandalay Bay or one of those malls in Las Vegas. And I think he actually will sign a ball saying, I'm sorry, I bet on baseball if you pay him enough money. So yeah, he's pretty shameless at that. I think he's one of those folks that he just can't seem to get out of his own way. And I think if he, you know, back in the '90s, he just said, you know what, I screwed up, I shouldn't have done it, I'm sorry, right away, I think he would have been in the Hall of Fame, you know, pretty quickly. But I think he's a very stubborn man, and he likes to play games with people. And I just don't see a path for him for getting into the Hall of Fame, you know, while he's alive. Because, like you say, he's on the Hall of Fame ineligible list, so he cannot be considered for induction in the Hall of Fame. And I think he's definitely in his mid-70s by now. I just don't see, you know, they just got a new commissioner a few years ago, and he said, it's not happening. So I just don't see a path for him. But in a way, he's his own worst enemy with this. And I think he just should have been more honest and upfront about it early on.
Although if he were in the Hall of Fame, he might have less lucrative income right now.
That's true.
He does. Now, other than things we've already mentioned, while you're doing research for the book, what new things did you learn that you found most interesting?
Yeah, I think for me it's just the overall picture of gambling, legalized gambling. I just there's 48 states where it's legal. You know, there's 44 states that have lotteries. There's 200,000 places you can buy lottery tickets. You know, and here in California, you can go, there's a 7-Eleven on every street corner. They're open 24/7. There's scratch-off tickets, you know, right next to the counter. Probably 20 of them you can pick from. Some of them have as much as $30 each. So you could buy those anytime. Grocery stores have kiosks where you can buy lottery tickets. There's about 900,000 slot machines, legal slot machines across the country, in about 1,000 casinos. So I think for me, it's just the weight of it and just how ingrained gambling is in our culture. I kind of sensed that was the case, but I think doing the research and really understanding, you know, how all these forms of gambling developed and how they became legal was really the most surprising thing to me, just the sheer weight of it.
Now, your book is up to date as of early 2017 when it went to press. In 5 years, there's going to be a lot of new gambling stuff to write about, including whatever is going to happen to the Supreme Court decision on sports betting. But we just don't know what that's going to be. Do you anticipate writing updates to this book down the road to keep it current or not?
Well, I think a lot of that's up to the publisher, because this book is a hardcover book, and they told me if your sales are good and it gets a good reaction, that they will do a paperback version at some point. So probably next couple years down the road. So yeah, hopefully the book succeeds and reaches an audience. And if it does, then I'm sure they'll want me to write an afterword or adjust maybe the sports gambling chapter to reflect whatever happens with the Supreme Court or other areas of gambling. So I think it's very possible. A lot of it's up to the audience and the publisher whether that happens. So I hope people can get the book and enjoy reading it.
Do you see it as an academic book, meaning somewhere across the country there would be a class in the history of American gambling, and this might be a textbook in that class? Do you see that? I don't know if there is such a class anywhere, but
I've done some looking around, and there are colleges that have gambling studies programs. I'll contact some professors who teach those kind of courses, the history of casinos or the history of gambling in America. And I definitely could see that being a good resource for college courses. So what I tried to do, even though it is published by Rutgers University Press, I tried to make this book as accessible as possible, like for somebody, I think people like you who are, know a lot about gambling. I hope there's a lot there for you to learn, and also people who don't, maybe aren't gamblers, but they're interested in history, or they're interested in politics, or they're interested in business, that there's something there for them as well. So I tried to make it as wide ranging and as appealing as I could for a broad audience.
Yeah, that part is true. Your publisher sent Richard and me copies a few weeks ago, and at one point Richard asked me, had I started it yet? And my response was, well, I've only read a couple of chapters, but there's some stuff in there that I didn't know, which is striking to me, because I've been reading about gambling for decades. And most gambling books or history books have, I'm going to know 95-98% of whatever's in there. And that wasn't true here. So I thought, if it's more than I knew about gambling, it's probably more than a lot of our readers knew, too.
Oh, that's really great to hear.
All right. We thank you very much for joining us today. I wish you success on your book, Gangster the Gobbler. And Richard, thank you. And our audience, go out and hit a royal flush, everybody. Good day.